Hello and welcome to another episode of The Fan and the Critic. We are here today with returning guest David and new guest John. We are here as a informal part two to two previous episodes that we've done. We did a dedicated episode for Dune, where we had varying levels of excitement about that. And then we had a dedicated episode to Rebel Moon, where we had a very consistent and low level of enjoyment for the part one of that. And because both part twos were coming out at the same time, we decided, hey, let's talk about these together. Let's compare them. Two great part two movies that we were all really looking forward to. So we're going to get into it. But before we do, we're going to go ahead, as we always do, introduce with new guests. So, John, this is your first time on the show. So why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself with three characters that you feel represent yourself as a person and why?
Thanks, Carson. Long-time listener, first-time caller. My name is John. And, you know, when I thought about this, the first character to come to mind right away was Mary from Lord of the Rings. I just, you know, ever since I was a kid, I always identified, you know, with him. He's kind of a goofball, optimistic, can sort of get serious when he needs to get serious. But, you know, he's not the big hero that's going to save the day. And I always kind of saw myself in him as a character. And you know, after I got over the fact that I thought, you know, bow and arrows were so cool, and then Legolas was my favorite just because he shot a bow and arrow, you know, I grew to really, you know, find Mary to be the one character I'm always really drawn to in the trilogy. The second on the list for me is Gomez Adams from the Adams Family.
Whoa, again, contrast.
Well, I don't know, because again, he's a goofball. He can kind of be, he's kind of peppy, and he's kind of got this optimistic outlook on life. He's like crazy about his wife, and he's so like his wife is so out of his league, which is how I feel. So I really kind of see myself in that. And then he's got the whole gothic vibe, right? And I was a huge emo kid, and you know, love all that kind of stuff, and still do. And so I like that kind of aspect, that gothic aspect of Gomez Adams. But you know, if we were talking about TV shows, I would have said Phil Dunphy. You know, that's the dad I want to be if and when I'm a dad. You know, that's who I look up to. And the last one from a more recent movie, Paul Hunnam, who is Paul Giamatti's character in The Holdovers. And, oh. You know, while I don't necessarily identify as a crotchety old man, I do love his kind of his desire to learn and his interest in, like, you know, ancient mythology. I'm all about that. I love that stuff. I'm always, you know, talking about Icarus flying too close to the sun to my wife, and she's like, what the hell are you talking about? But I'm always bringing in the Greek mythology stories, and so I really, really liked that character and kind of saw that part of myself in him.
The Gomez Adams, there's like a few different interpretations of that character. Which version would you say you're most related to?
So I guess, I mean, for me, it has to be the 1990s. Technically, I know he's a movie character, but the TV show, the Addams Family TV show that was airing in the mid-90s. So I guess that would be Raul Julia, you know, and he's always like, Morticia, that's French, right? Like, that is the Gomez Adams that I love. Technically, the one I'm thinking about is not the movie character, but the character has been in several movies.
That's okay. That really takes me back. Just you saying that too. Holy smokes. I forgot how much I actually watched that show.
All right. Well, thanks for that introduction. And David, you've already introduced yourself in the past, so we won't get you to reintroduce. But I think this is your second episode with the show. I think you joined us for one of our original episodes when we talked about heist movies. So welcome back.
Thanks, Ben.
All right. So first movie we're going to talk about Dune Part 2, and then we're going to transition to Rebel Moon Part 2 later in the episode. And just before we kind of get into the meat of the conversation, I wanted to do a quick roundtable on just what were your thoughts on the Dune Part 1? I assume everyone here watched that part. What was your anticipation for Dune Part 2? And then without going into too much detail, what was your general high-level thoughts of Dune Part 2? So maybe, David, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, in general, I thought Dune Part 1 was great. I mean, I remember watching the really old one a time ago, and it was so hard to kind of get through with the graphics. And then the second one they brought forward, I'm like, okay, this is a bit easier to follow. Just in general, like, Dune is such a massive saga. There's so much going on. There's so much history. Personally, I found it a little hard to follow, just with so many things going on and the characters and the depth of all the characters overall. But great, great movie. Once, if you can sit through it and really get into it, you know what I mean? But it feels more like a saga than it does a series or an episode. Sorry, not episode. Like a movie or a part two. Yeah, just great.
And I guess, sorry, one more bonus question. How much familiarity do you guys all have with the books to include in your answer as we go around?
Yeah, I don't have that much familiar with the books at all. And I guess that's part of it too, right? I think they were written a little while ago to my knowledge. 50s, so yeah.
In the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely shows in the way they make the movie and the way the characters are arced and the way that kind of travels throughout the timeline. And I think that's what makes it a little more difficult, but it kind of adds to this sci-fi world where it is just a little bit different than, I guess, your normal movies.
Awesome.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, Paul, go ahead.
I mean, I went over this in the episode that when we talked about it, but I have, like, I'm coming in cold to the universe of Dune, just like David. I never read any of the books, so I'm like, this is my watching the movies. I'd even watch the original movie back in the day, so like watching part one and part two was my introduction to Dune, so that's where I'm coming from.
And then what was your general high level thoughts on Dune 2 before we get into it?
Oh, okay. I mean, yeah, I'll try. I wanted to save that because I run the risk of like just going on forever about it, but I really loved it. If you saw our post on Instagram, I think I rated it like 99 out of 100.
That's the highest rating you've ever given on our Instagram. Yes.
It is. Or it was either that or, oh no, Barbie was like 96. So yeah, that was the highest rating. I don't know. I remember that was one of the few movies since my daughter's been born that we actually went to the theater to watch. And we made a point to do that on opening night. And I think it really helped that we had a lot of hype going into it, myself and my wife. And it was like, it matched like the excitement that we had. So that definitely lended to my high rating. And I mean, I'm a big fan of like how Denis Villeneuve, like how he builds like universes. Like he's done this before and like, in previous movies, like, oh my God, there's one that I'm forgetting and it's really going
to... Is it Blade Runner, Arrival?
Yeah, I was thinking of Arrival first, but Blade Runner is the other one, where like he builds these worlds and these universes, and it's not like... It feels like an action movie, even though there's not a whole lot of action. It's like the action is in kind of what the people are doing and like the I don't know, the political struggle or whatever, like the conflicts that they're having that are not necessarily like just big bombastic fight scenes that I usually am a fan of. So, but we'll get into that.
All right, John, how about yourself?
Yeah, so I read 4 of the Dune books. So Frank Herbert wrote 6 books. And then his son went on to write a whole bunch of other ones. But if I believe the internet, then I shouldn't bother reading those ones. But I read kind of 4 of the Dune books, which is sort of the mainline trilogy and story, or trilogy, there's 4, the story of kind of Paul Atreides in the kind of in the mid 2010s. And then, you know, I watched the David Lynch version. And then I eagerly awaited, you know, when Dune was announced, I was so excited. And they got the cast together, and then Denis Villeneuve, who basically is my favorite director, on to direct it. Like that was super exciting for me. So I went into Dune 1 with, you know, pretty high expectations. It's a good movie. I thought he did well, like creating that universe, and it certainly, you know, felt a little more kind of real and lived in than the Lynch version. Yeah, obviously it suffered from part one ism, right, where it kind of ended, and I was like, I want more. What do you mean? But of course I knew this was going to happen because you know, I'd read the book and it's kind of massive, and you don't want to just blaze through it. And so, you know, my anticipations for the second movie, knowing what happens in the second half, and it's like, okay, first movie's all set up, second movie's all payoff. I'd say I have really, really high expectations for the second movie, which were met, and I really, really enjoyed the movie. But the one thing I actually think is because my expectations were so high and they were met, it's like, it wasn't like I was surprised. and I've found that some of my favorite movie experiences that have really stuck with me, have been surprise. And so like, I don't expect anything and I go in and just watch something blind and I'm blown away. And so, you know, I thought it was a really great, adaptation of the book. Again, beautiful shots, great action, really invested. So yeah, not a 99, maybe like a 85 to 90 for me.
Fair. Okay. And then for myself, definitely I can relate to that part one-ism that you're talking about on the first one, where Denis Villeneuve is one of my favorite directors. I was really looking forward to it. And then I think I was pretty disappointed just because, and I mean, even comparing it to other part ones, like Fellowship of the Ring is maybe an unfair comparison because it's such a good trilogy, but like Fellowship of the Ring is a very satisfying movie on its own, where I felt like Dune part one, it just felt incomplete, even though I respected it so much as a movie. So I was a little disappointing and I was expecting, you know, part two to wrap it up and to look at it as two whole movies together a lot better. So I had, even though I was a little bit disappointed, I still had some expectations going into part two. I was very bored by Dune Part 2. I respect it as a movie, but I think of the four of us here, I'm probably going to be the detractor of the group here. So again, I respect it a lot. I still like Denis Villeneuve as a director. I felt no emotion in this movie. So that said, who wants to dive into it with their initial thoughts then? Paul, I felt like you were getting to go in a little bit. So what other...
I guess one of the things that surprises me but also doesn't surprise me about like the fact that you were bored about it is that you felt no emotion, because like, granted, it's you, but like I felt like the emotion or like the what I felt watching the movie was one of the high points, like the emotions that it brought out of me when I was watching the movie, just because like the story, it was such, I guess the story just really resonated with me, like him, Paul Atreides kind of struggling against like having all this power and like the oh my God, what are their names? The Fremen. Desert people. Fremen, yeah. Fremen. The Fremen, like kind of, there's a split between the blind followers, like Stilgar, who's hilarious, by the way. And like the other people who don't really believe as much, so I guess like Chani, and kind of like also at the same time, his mother is like, you don't really know if she's bad. Like the whole time, I spent the whole movie a little bit confused, but in a good way. Like, okay, is she actually a bad person now because she's like feeding the prophecy stuff to the Fremen, like the fanatics, to kind of like build his strength and his power so that he can you know, start this holy war, quote unquote. Like all that, plus there's the love story between him and Chani, which like is not really my thing, but then my wife was really into that, so like she really enjoyed that part of it. So there's like a lot going on, like a lot of layers to it, and I just really like, I was on board, I was fully on board. And like I mentioned before, usually I'm like, okay, for these kinds of movies, I want story. Like I want a good story. I want the characters. I want to enjoy the ride. And then at the end, I want my big battle so that I can like just watch things explode. Right. which I mean, Dune 2 didn't even really have that. Like you have the sandworms just annihilating the Sardaukar, which is great, but it's like a 5-minute battle where it's been built up over two movies. And normally I'd be like, okay, what the hell is this? But just the fact that it was so well, like the story was so well told, It took its time, and just like the atmosphere of the movie. So like just the visuals and everything and all the characters that were just really cool to me. I mean, I loved it. And then, yeah, I think I'll leave it at that for now.
You mentioned Stilgar, and I will say that was my favorite part of the movie. I think Javier Bardem played him perfectly. If you play it just a little bit more goofy, it wouldn't have fit into the movie at all. But if it was any more dry, then I think the movie would have ended up being too boring. So, like, I loved his performance in it.
Yeah, he definitely stole the show, for sure. Like, I mean, especially in a movie where, I mean, it's 99% serious. He's like, you always have that one bright spot. And like you said, he played it perfectly to kind of give balance.
Yeah, the fanaticism, like the idea of the religion, that was always my favorite thing about the Dune books. Like, it was like, my mind was blown. I was like, you mean this society just put all these religions out there just in case in all these planets to fulfill their prophecy they think is going to happen 20,000 years from now? And then, you know, it's kind of, they land on this planet. They have this challenge and they're like, okay, they're trying to think, because in the books you get the view from their head, like there's a lot of internal monologue, and like they're trying to remember, like, okay, what was the prophecy in this place again? Like, how did that go? And like, how can we kind of manipulate that? And so I always thought like that was the most interesting theme, right? Like they just kind of come in, co-opt a religion to kind of start this war. And I thought, yeah, Denis did a really good job. And especially one of the big adaptation changes, I'd say, was Chani's role, which is much more kind of, I'll call it supportive in the books, because in the book you have Paul Atreides' head and you're inside his head and he's wrestling with this decision. A lot of it's internal and his thoughts. And so I really like that change for having Chani, you know, voice that. And to be honest, otherwise you might not even realize that it's so bad. Like what I thought about when I thought about Dune was Dune 2. You know, at the end, once Paul takes the water of life and he just takes control, like he walks into that gathering they have, they're all sitting.
Yeah.
He's no longer questioning himself. He just storms in there, says, you know, listen to me, says something about a guy's grandmother, you know, and becomes this badass, right? And that whole time, like as you go through and then he, you know, does all the stuff and you're like, yeah, I want to follow this guy. And then the movie kind of succeeded in making me feel like, you know, creating that idea that, oh, Paul's this great hero that I want to follow. And then I kind of come back after and be like, wait a minute, though. He just kind of completely manipulated these people based on this religion. And now he's going to start this massive war. And right now he's killing guys that I think are bad. Right. And now he's going to go off and just start killing people who weren't even involved. Right. And aren't bad or good. You don't even know. Right. And so I think the movie did a good job of, like, when that switch flipped in Paul, I really felt like so much more engaged in him, which is the problem. I think that they're trying to say with the movie, right? Mm-hmm. And as the series progresses, they kind of get more and more into that. So I thought that was much better than, you know, in the original Dune, where I kind of didn't, the David Lynch version, where they don't have Chani kind of voicing that voice of, hey, what, this is messed up. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of more supportive, and in the end you're left with, hey, we beat the bad guys, great, you know.
Like, it's not that simple.
There's, yeah, and I like that, you know. I like when there's a little more to it than just there's these evil guys who are obviously evil and we're gonna beat them because we're the good guys.
Yeah, I'll pat myself on the back a little bit, just because, like, that the whole moment that you were talking about where he drinks the water of life and then he gives that whole speech to the Fremen. At that point, I was like, okay, whoa, this is, I feel like he's kind of lost the plot now. Like, I don't know if I'm on board with this guy anymore, which I think is kind of like the message. Well, like you mentioned, but yeah. I don't know if it has anything to do with me not being a super, like, that much of a fan of Timothée Chalamet, but I know Carson, that probably resonates with Carson a little bit more.
Yeah, that scene was actually one of the things that bothered me the most, because it felt like the scene that was the most, I'm Timothée Chalamet, look at me act. Because, like, the lead up to that, like, they, on one hand, they're foreshadowing his turn, like, way too far away. And so by the time it gets there, it's like, of course this is happening. Like, it's not, I feel like they didn't try to trick me into liking Timothée Chalamet before it takes that turn. Like, and oddly enough, I compare this a lot to Star Wars Episode 3 with Anakin Skywalker. And even though that's a really bad movie, like, I almost feel like they did a better job of there of showing that transition a little bit. But I don't know how much of that is me just not liking Timothée Chalamet. Because in that scene, I was like, okay, guys, stop trying to win your Oscar here. Like, the scene is just not matching up with the rest of the movie.
I feel like a lot of it is that. Sorry, go ahead, David.
Yeah, no, I was kind of with Carson and you, Paulo, on Dune in the sense that, like, I didn't feel a lot of emotion watching this movie. I kind of felt like I knew where everything was kind of going for the most part. I felt if I were to distance myself and start thinking about it a lot deeper, like, you know, the geopolitics and power and, like, resource struggles and religion, like, you're tying in all these massive themes into this movie, which makes it incredibly, you know, in-depth and complex. But at the same time, it's like, you know, which part do I want to focus on? Which is the most important here? And I think in one of the scenes, someone goes like plans within plans. And this is just the entire movie. There's just plans within plans within plans. And it's like, okay, well, there's so many plans that what do I tune into, right? And you're trying to pull it apart. And you just can't. You just can't really figure out who's good and who's bad and, like, you know, whose plan is usurping the other plan or who has the better plan. And, you know, in that sense, it was like, it's a bit overwhelming for me and a bit hard to follow, right? So it's like hard to tap into it and really, like, get into the movie a lot for me.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And, like, that's, I mean, where you, like, it felt like it was overwhelming for you. That was, like, the part that really drew me into the story, like, the all those layers. And it just, like, the fact that it wasn't so straightforward, like I mentioned how, like, I could never tell if his mother was a good character or not anymore by the end. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I felt like, I guess I'd compare it to Game of Thrones a little bit. Just, yeah. Like, yeah. Which, I mean, yeah. Is kind of, oh, what, John?
Oh, no, that just brings up something. I'll let you finish before I say that, though.
Yeah, it's like none of them are good. Like, the whole thing is like, none of them are good. All of them are absolutely bad.
Except for Stilgar.
Yeah. Well, he's not good either because he goes, now he's leading, like, the war waging.
No,
right?
I don't.
But, you know, it's funny you say that because it's like, yeah, he has this big victory in the end. And it's like, you're like, great, but also not great. And it reminded me a lot of a Game of Thrones episode, which I kind of really liked. But it didn't feel good. Like, it was the one where, spoilers, they're finally attacking King's Landing. Like, hey, here's the bad guys, right? The bad guys are here. We're going to get Cersei. And I loved it. It was just like this overwhelming show of force. Like, her people didn't stand a chance, right? The dragons come, blow up all the things, blows up the gate. The good guys just run in there. And when it all stops and like, they're kind of going to surrender, and then Daenerys starts burning the city, and then all the good soldiers just are like, fuck it, right? Let's kill everybody. Like, and the other guys had dropped their swords, and the good guys start killing everybody in the city, peasants, fighters who surrendered already. And it's just like, I felt terrible watching that, and I didn't feel good. But I'm like, that's a very interesting thing to say, right? To force me to be like, well, you thought your guys were the good guys, but nobody really ever looks good when they actually have a victory like this. And so it's interesting you said the Game of Thrones thing, because I thought, again, at the time, I was kind of like almost let down in a way. But as the more I thought about it, I'm like, well, this is actually interesting and awful. And I like feeling like that.
Yeah, and a lot of people hated on, like, the Game of Thrones ending. Like, I loved that twist. Like, I was mentioning Anakin Skywalker, but, like, the Daenerys is probably a better version of both of these. which, bringing it back to Dune, was, like, there was nothing that made me ever empathize with Paul or made me like him as a character or thought that he was doing this for a specific reason. He was just, like, kind of going through the motions and be like, oh, you're supposed to be a savior, and then he's obviously going to be evil at the end. Whereas, like, with Daenerys, you can kind of feel like she has a point. She believes she's good. And you can see that power kind of corrupt her, and you as the audience kind of see that over time. But there was just nothing that made me got on board with Paul where that I cared about him turning at the end.
Okay, so now I really think that this is just you not liking Timothée Chalamet. Like, 100%. Because, like, that's, like, not the whole point of the love story, but there's like a bunch of stuff at the beginning of the movie where he's like, he's even struggling against his mother, right? Because like he's seeing what she's doing, like the plans on plans that she's putting into motion in the background. Like he's trying to, like he loves Chani and he's like trying to,
I never felt the whole Chani thing, like that whole romance. Like I like Zendaya as an actress, but like I never understood why she liked him in the first place, or like he liked her.
Yeah, I mean, okay, I didn't get that either. Like the romance part is not the biggest part for me, but like I'm just saying it's in service of show of making Timothée Chalamet like a little more sympathetic, or to show that maybe he does want to do the good thing, right? Like he wants to learn how to be a Fremen so he can be with Chani, or he wants to be like an equal to her so he can be with her. And he wants, like, he doesn't want to go north, south. I can't remember. So, he doesn't want to go in the one direction because he knows what will happen. So for me, and also because I guess I didn't know what was going to happen at all, like not reading any of the books or anything, like, okay, is he, like, I knew he was going to go there eventually, but the only question in my mind, like I wasn't sure if, okay, is he just going to buy into this whole thing and then just run, like turn into that holy war leader, like it was being foreshadowed, or if he's going to like stay good, like a traditional good guy. So I think, I don't know, it's 50%, no, like 80% you not liking Timothée Chalamet and like 20% already knowing what's going to happen. For you, I mean.
It's a possibility, I will admit. I am a little bit biased heading into this. But I love, like, literally every other actor that's in this movie. I love, like, all of these people, like, absolutely nailed their roles. And so, like, if anything, I almost felt like I was going to be biased towards liking this movie going into it. Because I like this type of movie. I like Denis Villeneuve. I like all the, like, even the cinematography. It's all great. It's like a fantastically well-made movie that I just happen to don't care about the story for.
Which is fair. I mean, yeah. I understand that. I guess it just comes down to preference. I think the only main gripe that I have, which is completely unrelated, is that the Fremen never really, or like the good guys / Fremen never really feel like they're in trouble. It's just like they're succeeding the entire time. So there's not a whole lot of conflict there. And like the one victory that the Harkonnens have over their, like, I think the siege where all the water was kind of not forced, but it was just like, oh, okay, they used old artillery to blow up the cave that they could never find before. Okay. But that was like the one little thing that I had. If I have to complain about something.
We haven't talked about the Harkonnens at all and Fade and all that. How did you guys feel about them?
I loved, like, especially their planet. Like I love when the movie kind of took that turn and you go to their planet with that just really cool design, like the black and white with the fireworks. But very much a big Austin Butler fan in this. I saw Elvis, it was kind of boring. I really kind of like the character. He's kind of this psychopath, but at the same time, he's got this kind of quote unquote honorable, you know, way about going about things. And I knew, like, you know, the gladiator scene is kind of the big scene for the introduction of Fade in the books as well. And I thought they kind of did that justice in terms of that kind of introduction. Obviously a little, you know, a little cartoonishly evil, but when they sprinkle in like the sort of quote, like little honorable aspects, right? He fights the guy even though he doesn't have to, right? You know, that made me kind of like, and that character stand out for me as a kind of villain.
Yeah, I think the only thing about him was that it felt like he was kind of wasted because they built him up pretty well and he was interesting. Like I would have liked to see a struggle between him and Paul a little bit more, but the first time that they see each other, he's immediately killed, which I guess it's like true to the books or the original story, but it felt like a bit of a waste for me. Also, like in the theater, I just remember this was really annoying. He, like, the Harkonnen stuff and Fade was super cool, but the people sitting behind me were like giggling the entire time, and it was like annoy me so much, so it kind of ruined like part of the Harkonnen stuff for me.
I liked it visually, but every time we went to the Harkonnen homeworld, I was like, what do people on this planet do all day? Because it seems like they went to this gladiator ring to see like a 5-minute match, and then I think when they send off Fade to go back to the other planet, like there's just like thousands and thousands of people like cheering for him to go on a spaceship. I was like, anyway, the cynical part of my brain was asking too many questions at that point.
It's like North Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, visually the Harkonnen homeworld is crazy. I like that whole backdrop, the black and the white, and even the fireworks, super cool watching them kind of like implode on themselves instead of explode. Thought that was super neat. Every time I watch this movie, I'm just like, hey, like there's this Roman kind of backdrop to everything with the gladiator realm, and then there's the emperor in charge, and they're kind of struggling to see who's going to be the top or who can be of use to like the empire kind of per se. But yeah, I mean, they built him up, like you said, and then they kind of just, he just kind of faded out, right? There's this other backdrop where, you know, Atreides end up not being Atreides, he's Harkonnen, right? And kind of have this culture where it's like, it's the strongest one who is in charge or gets the most responsibility. So then, you know, that kind of adds like another level to that culture. And I'm like, I don't really understand, like, how is this going to work out? But I mean, overall, I think pretty interesting, but yeah.
I liked how the Harkonnens got killed. Like I thought it was a great choice that instead of having this big, you know, epic showdown between Gurney, Josh Brolin, and Raban, who was Dave Bautista, like he just gets iced instantly. Yeah. Because like he's actually not a good fighter, like he's never been really fighting, he's only ever had overwhelming force against any of his opponents, so he's never really had to like have any skill. And so I like that choice. He just pulls out his whip, Josh Brolin kind of walks up to him and just kills him. And then ditto for the Baron too, right? It was like, you know, you have all these schemes and plans and plans, and then in the end, you know, the Emperor, he's already dying before the Hall even comes and finishes him off, because the Emperor's just like, I'm done with you.
I can't ever stop thinking. I keep seeing it. I'm like, oh, Jabba the Hutt. And then I was like, maybe it's not, because maybe he came out first. And I'm like, it's the other way around. Like, maybe Jabba was based on him, not the other way. And I just can't ever get that out of my mind whenever he pops into a scene.
Well, that's true. Very similar.
We'll talk about the parallels pretty soon, I think, especially when we get into Rebel Moon.
So one thing I'll say about Dune is, so I had read the book a long time ago. Don't even like remember it, but I remembered like the main plot points just of the first book. I had been purposely trying to avoid plot points for future books because I assumed like this is a well-made adaptation. I want to like go into those as fresh as possible. I did end up digging through Wikipedia and like going through the story. And I'm not going to spoil for those of you who want to keep it, but it's like utter nonsense. Like, I thought it was going to be this master story, and I was like, oh my God, this is just ridiculous. Well. And I'm sorry, like, okay. I'm sure it'll go into some good details at some point, but I was surprised, I'll say.
Get him, John, get him.
Yeah, I would say that the next book is a really good and interesting one. And I know Denis says that, hey, he wants to do that next one, because it kind of, you can kind of end there, and you can kind of end at the book after that. But yeah, the further you go, like the second book, I kind of really liked a lot. I liked the third book and the fourth book too, but you just get weirder and weirder stuff that's harder and harder to ignore how strange it is, for sure.
And again, I only read like the overlaying synopsis. It seems like Denny would be the right director for the next one. And after that, you would have to hand it off to some director who embraces the silliness.
Yeah, actually, and there was a mini series made in the early 2000s, starting at the later Dune book. So they actually skipped Dune 1. And yeah, it's kind of ridiculous.
Question for you guys. Did anyone else watch Dune 84 at around the same time?
I watched it several years ago, so it's kind of there in my head.
This is another nail in the Carson hates this movie just because of Timothy Chalamet, but... I enjoyed Paul Atreides in the David Lynch version. I thought that was an appropriate version of the character. Obviously, there's a lot of problems with those movies, but I thought Paul Atreides was actually better in the original one than this one.
I So I haven't seen the, like, I started watching the 84 one after I watched Doom Part 2. And I'm only like, I don't know, maybe 30 minutes in, but it is rough. And Paul Atreides in that one, 84, he comes across a little like goofy. I don't know. No, maybe not goofy, but he's like a little like.
But that's what I liked about it. Like, he seems like that very typical, like, Harry Potter, Luke Skywalker, like, white savior, I'm just a little kid who was told I'm now going to be the future of the universe type thing. Because starting from there and going on the Paul Atreides arc, I think, is much more interesting than starting with boring, angsty Timothy Chalamet.
Which is fair. I mean, it's got to be modern somehow, right? And that's Timothy Chalamet's thing. It's just, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing that I'm saying about Paul Atreides in Dune 84, but it just, I think it's like deeper than him playing the character. It just, or no, it's actually him playing the character, but it's just strange to me how, like, I think it's because he looks so old, but he's trying, it looks like he's trying to play just a young boy. So it looks weird. Like, it's just, he's Simple Jack almost. No, that's okay, that's not right. No, forget I said that.
Are you saying Jack. That about Timothy Chalamet or the Dune 84?
No, I'm talking about
I think he's saying about Kyle MacLachlan.
Okay.
Yes, let's just strike that from the record.
One
last point that I wanted to make about Dune 84 and Dune, like the current ones. I want to give even more kudos to Denis Villeneuve, because like I feel like Dune 84, like timeline or the effects available at the time aside, I feel like it's a good representation of like if you have this just completely wild and out there source material that you're trying to put into a movie, it could easily turn into like some cheesy looking, like it, like bordering on silly and almost not like completely unserious, versus like the story that we have with Dune and how it looks. I mean, like, sorry, effects aside, the story and like the seriousness or the gravity that it has, I think I give kudos to Denis Villeneuve for actually making like a serious and competent story out of that.
So on that question, or building off of that, have any of you guys seen the documentary Jodorowsky's Dune? Anyway, there was this Mexican director who was almost the one to make the 84 Dune, and he makes like these wild, absurd movies. Like, the only thing I remember from one of them is like Jesus shows up and poops gold at one point, but it's just like way, like he's on acid. He just make crazy movies. And he was originally assigned with making this movie, and he had like Mick Jagger signed up to do Paul Atreides. He had
Salvador Dali was...
Yeah, Dali was the emperor, and you had, like, Orson Welles as, like, Harkonnen, like, all this crazy stuff. And so, like, the David Lynch version is the boring, toned-down version that movie almost was. But I highly recommend that documentary. It's really, really good.
After 84, watch it.
Speaking of adaptation choices, the one thing, so as a book reader, this was one of the biggest changes in the movie, and I'm curious about what you guys, not about the change, but what you thought about this piece. And so in the books, Alia, his sister, is born, and she gets to be about 2 years old, and she's like this two-year-old walking around, but she has the memories of like all her past ancestors, so she's talking like a normal adult, and she actually kills the Baron. Like, she just somehow like jumps up and knifes him in the neck and kills him in that kind of final scene. And I thought it was a really interesting and probably good choice, because I was like, how the hell are they going to do that? That was my biggest question about part two. But it was so strange and weird. But it worked when they like made her character instead, you know, just not be born yet. And so the mom is like talking to the fetus, which I thought was like so bizarre, but worked in this and added to the strangeness that I think, you know, the Dune 84 had a lot of strangeness, and some of the strangeness was toned away, but like, I like that they did this, and it kind of added to the insanity of the, you know, of Paul's mother.
As somebody who has a 2-year-old daughter, I was most looking forward to that part and was disappointed that it was not part of it.
I think the only thought that I had was, of course, it's Anya Taylor-Joy. when it was like revealed who the daughter was, and the whole like talking to the fetus, that stuff was super creepy to me. Like with the mother, it just helped build the mother's creepiness and villainosity. I'm just making up words now. I would have liked to see it happen that way as well, but I think with the whole tone of the movie, the guys sitting behind me probably would have bust out in laughter if the little girl was born and murdered the Baron at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know that was in the book, but I mean, it wouldn't even surprise me if that did happen, because I'm just like, yeah, this fits the plot completely.
But yeah, it doesn't really fit the Denis Villeneuve version of this movie. So it's like, I'm not surprised, and it's probably more appropriate for what he was looking for. But which is why, again, if you want to embrace the silliness of future movies, like, you can't keep it too serious for too long, because you're going to have to wildly start changing the plot.
And on that note, like, I guess it's easier for you, Carson, and John, and maybe even a little bit for you, Knox, because I think you have a little more knowledge about the full story than I do. But what are your predictions for the next one? Or like, what do you think is going to happen? Or what do you expect are looking forward to being represented in the third movie based on like the rest of the story?
I don't really have much to say, because I don't know what to expect completely. I think for me, I just kind of watch Dune for what it is, right? I have no expectations for it. And just kind of follow it along the way. To me, it's so complex, I can't really figure out where it's going in the first place. And I feel like if I had those expectations, it would kind of take away a little bit from it being so different, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the same boat as you.
I think for me, having read the book, what I really liked about the next book was, especially in the books, like in the movie that with Chani, again, they kind of drill it in a little more. But, you know, so far you've seen him, quote unquote, maybe turn evil. But so far, all he does is kill the bad guys who are, you know, look like bad guys. Right. And killed his whole family. And you know, you saw killed them, Jason Momoa. Right. And you're Oscar Isaac. And so I really like in the next book, it's kind of like the aftermath of, hey, well, now it's continued. Like what he was worried about the whole time, what he was conflicted about the whole time, wasn't this part that you saw in the movie. It's afterwards. And so for me, it really was where all the themes come together a little more, because you see it happening. You aren't just being told that, hey, in the future, this is going to happen if I do this. So I really enjoyed that about the next one. And I feel like Denis could do a really good job on it. It's very political, lots of palace intrigue and stuff.
Yeah, this won't surprise you guys, but I'm most looking forward to Timothée Chalamet becoming less important to the story. But I have a feeling that they're going to find a way to wrap it up as a nice, clean trilogy on a way that centers around Paul a little bit more. Because, and again, I'm basing all of this off of a Wikipedia synopsis of future books, but it seems like the next book would kind of lead more into more like other things. And I feel like they want to, I mean, Timothée Chalamet is your star. It's what everyone like talks about with this. So I think they're going to want to clean that up and kind of wrap it up in a nice little bow.
I mean, there's a lot of potential there. Like the way that part two ended is complete. I feel like it's completely open now, because they're finally leaving Arrakis, and it's just, I mean, it could be just this giant war, interplanetary war. It just feels completely open to me. So that's why I ask, like, I have no idea. I have even less of an idea of what's going to happen between now and part three versus part one and part two.
And we'll say one of the things I'm most looking for, well, again, I don't know the exact details, but like the things that I've liked the most about part one and two is the Bene Gesserit. And just like how they're in control and how they're doing things behind the scenes. And like, I think they're going to, but just like getting into a little bit more detail on that. And I assume because they cast Lea Seydo in a kind of a very small role that she's going to be more in like, cause in part one, you had Javier Bardem as Stilgar and he was barely in the movie. But when you cast somebody like that, then it's kind of saying, okay, this person's going to show up more in later movies. So I hope she comes back and I hope they do more stuff with him.
Yeah. Or it'll just be all Anya Taylor-Joy.
I am okay with that as well.
I'm also okay with that. Not as it wasn't a bad thing.
All right. Any final comments you guys have around Dune 2 or any random things you want to mention before we move on?
No. The only recommendation is that I have, and I've said this to anyone that's talked about watching it, don't watch the last showing of the evening if you're watching it in theaters. Which actually I don't even think is it still in theaters? It's been a while.
I think it is.
Okay. You will end at 3 a.m.
Yeah, does not feel like a 3-hour movie though, but
it doesn't. It doesn't.
All right. Let's move on then. Let's talk about a different part one and part two, which was a movie that I had similar level of excitement for at the very beginning, but this is Rebel Moon. So similar to what we did for Dune, just want to go around and ask you guys, like, what did you guys think of part one? What were you expecting for part two? And then how did you very high level feel about part two? So David, how about we start with you first again?
Yeah, I liked Rebel Moon. I kind of like those more like action movies, and it felt like an action heist movie where, you know, typical these small farmers are getting attacked by this massive empire, and then they have to reunite a bunch of heroes to try to save them, right? And they kind of hop from planet to planet, and it's so different from each one that it's doesn't have to be this huge in-depth building of characters and movies. You kind of really just jump right into it. And they give you kind of a backstory. And that was sufficient for me for Rebel Moon 1. I mean, I wasn't sure, you know, there was a bit of twist at the end where they all got captured. And I'm like, oh, are they all going to die? Because this would be great, right? I don't see that very often where you just murder all the heroes, right? And I guess losing them along the way as well and not having them all survive takes away that, like, Marvel-esque kind of, like, hero thing that they have going on where they're unstoppable and they can't be killed and the best. I really enjoyed characters kind of dying along the way. Makes it a little bit more, I guess, not meaningful, but a little bit more emotional. Like, okay, I don't know what's going to happen here, right? As for Rebel Moon 2, you know, having them kind of get to the planet and set everything up, I kind of knew where the arc was going in the first place. Wasn't sure if they were going to do a 3, and I'm like, okay, they're absolutely going to add one onto there as well. But 2, for the most part, it felt like a continuation of 1, not like 2 separate movies altogether. So I kind of enjoy having that united like storyline and plot built in. But yeah, no, I kind of just enjoyed both movies for the most part.
All right, Paulo, over to you.
Oh, okay. I didn't like, I liked 2 a little bit more than 1, but I have a whole bunch of like complaints. Like, okay, I'll try not to speak on 1 too much because we already did a whole episode about it. And you know me, I'm usually the one who likes like just mindless action, and like the whole story, like you mentioned, David, with like the concept, I'm totally into that 100%. Like, I don't know if any of you have seen Magnificent Seven, which is like similar story, which is also like a retelling of, was it Seven Samurai?
Yep.
And like there's countless movies like based on that same concept. And Magnificent Seven by like in itself is not a great movie, but like the characters are charismatic enough. I found like I cared about them.
You're talking about the remake of Magnificent Seven, by the way, right?
Sorry, yes, the more recent one with like Chris Pratt and Denzel Washington in it. like, because that one's, yeah, like I said, it's not a great movie. It's not like winning any awards, but I'm into the simple story, some cool action at the end. The big battle at the end was like what I'm looking for, and it's what I get. Awesome. I think, like I've mentioned before, Rebel Moon 1, I didn't really feel anything for the characters, just because like they just jumped from planet to planet, and then they were like, okay, I'll join you now. And it was like, oh, okay, that's it. And this,
yeah, you son of a bitch, I'm in. You know what I mean? Just like,
yeah, which is like, okay, it's fine, but like, I know absolutely nothing about any of these people. So like, if they die, I'm like, okay, that's sure. which I mean, like one of them did at the end, like the rebel leader, who like, I don't know, the Ray
Gunnar.
Fisher?
Gunnar.
Yes.
Oh, him, oh sorry. That, oh, sorry. That's, you're talking about the first one.
Yes, the first one. Sorry, I'm still on the first one.
Ray Fisher. Yeah.
That, even though I said I wasn't going to talk about it too much, but like he dies, and I'm like, okay, I just met him, and he's gone. That's fine. And then in the second one, like you said, David, it's like it's more of the same, but it also feels like the whole part one is wasted, because it's there. This is the whole time where you set everything up, right? Like you get to really know your characters, so you care about them. And it's like a similar thing. And it's like a complaint that people have about Dune part one is that it's all set up, right? It feels like unfinished. But Rebel Moon part one is like, okay, this is where you do that. But then in Rebel Moon Part 2, the first half of the movie is them sitting around a table like, tell us your story. Like, and they talked about, like, they don't even, they don't really explain anything new about each character when they're having their little share circle in the village. It's literally like the same stuff that they talked about in Rebel Moon Part 1. So it's like, You had a whole like 2 hours to do this, and now you're doing it again, and then it goes straight to the battle, which I was actually super like the action I liked. it could have been like just a 20-minute action scene, like the whole movie, and I've been like, yeah, this is cool. Like I like how the design of the laser swords, like they seem so like just chaotic, and like it overheats in her hand, like that was cool. And like how the laser guns like shoot, like it seems like molten lava like come out like anytime something gets shot. And like Sophia Boutella is like she does great action, like she like in Kingsman and I forget whether Hotel Artemis, which is like I don't think anyone saw, but she's good at action. It's just like the story, it was like there's I didn't care about any of the people. Like there's like big dramatic stings at the end where like one of the villagers was fighting the admiral in the plane, and then he like dies and he gets kicked out of the plane, and it's like I didn't even know his name. And this like there's a huge focus on
it's
on
Den.
Him. Den, Den, yeah. Actually, I only knew his name because of the subtitles were on. It was like Den Grunts.
Yeah. And then I watched with subtitles. Yeah.
This is Den, yeah.
That's one thing though. The actions are so great. I mean, when they're in the dreadnought and it tips down and they're fighting as they're falling.
Yeah,
like cool. I haven't seen that done before. I'm like, this is good. I love this.
See, I would disagree. So for me, like the excitement of action like comes from giving a shit about the result of said action. And so for me, because my main gripe with the movie was because I couldn't get into it because it all seemed so silly and self-serious. Like, it just pushed me further away. And I was more like the guys behind Hollow at the movie theater, right? Where, like, something, like, maybe serious is happening, but I'm kind of, like, laughing because – or I'm just, like, cringing or rolling my eyes. And I found, like, that happening, you know, kind of more and more. And then when you get to the action, like, one of my notes I wrote down, I was like, did I – like, was 300 a bad movie? Was I just 15? You know, like as the slow-mo, like all the slow-mo just had me kind of rolling my eyes. And I was thinking, actually, when they did the sliding down, like I'd just seen Mission Impossible this summer, where there's like this great scene where Tom Cruise and whoever he's with, I think Hayley Atwell, they're in this train and it's falling off a cliff. And like all this stuff is falling at them and maybe they're fighting guys. I can't remember, but I just remember like the excitement of that scene, because there'd be like action and then pause and action, and the sound design, like stuff was falling down. And I just thought, like, when they were sliding down that thing, the plane or the ship, when it was crashing, I just kind of like had a lot of the action stuff that I wasn't really feeling, where there's just like slow-mo and one particular shot of Ed Skrein's face where he's trying to grab the thing. And I was like, oh my God, that's a terrible shot. Like, it looks so CGI guarding the sword. I did like the door thing. But you know, generally, like, I feel my overall feeling on Rebel Moon was, it was hard. It didn't give me anything new, and it was hard for me to be excited about the characters. And so a lot of the action fell flat because it felt corny, and I wasn't like bought in.
It's funny you guys bring up Den, because that was the one part of part two where I was like, hey, here's finally a character I actually know who he is and I care about him a little bit, because he was in part one and he was the one that like Korra was supposed to marry, and he was like the one character where I felt like he had a personality and I understood who he was and what he was doing. Because my entire impression of part two was just shockingly little character development for all of these characters. And like, you guys talked about the scene where they're sitting around their table sharing their backstories, which is like, I knew that scene was going to come. And my complaint when we talked about this in our first episode was, they're going to do a whole 45 minutes on just these guys' backgrounds because they didn't tell us anything about them in the first movie. And there was just shockingly little, like, it was like a 2 minute, here's a little, like, and also very expensive videos. Like, this, the amount of set design and work that they did for those to really tell us nothing about these characters was just shocking. And then the other version of that scene was when they're in the village before the fight and the woman is making them a little banner. Like, that's the scene where you start to show the differences in the characters. Like, I was imagining them doing that same scene, but with like the Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's like, you give the little thing to Drax and he has a comedic, like, what is this type thing? Or like, you give it to Mantis and she loves, and you start to see the differences in the characters, but they do this little introduction for each character and they're just like, thank you. And that's it. That's the whole scene. And it was just like, I just kept waiting for them to give us something about the characters, to the point where I was like making up stories for them in my head. Like, there's a point where they almost win at the end, and Jimon Hounsou, he's like, he has a disappointed look on his face. And I started making like a background, like a character for him of like, oh, he's disappointed that he lived through this. Like, he wanted to die. He wanted to have like this regret. And it's like, no, they didn't do anything. It's just, that's it. There's no character. So yeah, it's hard to care about what happens to the characters when you don't even know who they are.
Yeah. I mean, that was my big thing. Like, I'm caught directly in the middle, because I really hate that they didn't do anything with the characters. But like I said, the action, well, in part two, like, part one was like a little bit of nothing for me, but part two was like, at least it looks nice. I mean, part of it, like, there's Dora, John, I got you. And this was a huge complaint that I had in part one as well, because like the visuals are all over the place. Like, I mentioned in our first episode, there's parts of the movie where it looks like they're on stage, like in a play, like it's built by like the community.
My theory on that one was like, they were finishing up the visual effects for this movie and they were seeing the reviews for part one and they're like, just don't bother. We're not going to pay for that.
Yeah. Well, like for the like practical sets or like,
or just finishing up the effects on part two of like, let's not spend any more money on this, 'cause no one likes it anyway.
Yeah, because like, John, you mentioned the scene or like the shot of Ed Skrein's face when he's like jumping in slow motion and he's like screaming, but he looks like he's made out of clay. Yeah, the CGI is so bad. That shot stuck with me. Like, you have some of these really cool things, like with the volatile laser sword, that looks great. And then you have the ships flying through space or like flying over a planet, and the buildings look like they were made in Microsoft Paint. Like, it was just so, like, it was insane to me that like, I couldn't believe the contrast between some of the effects. It was like really weird, but I mean, it also added to the experience where I was just like kind of enjoying, enjoying like the wreck.
But to one
did,
of the
did
points
you guys
that
ever catch?
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, did you ever catch like the things? I always got distracted when stuff was weirdly out of focus. Like there'd be a shot of them all like riding the horses up to the village, and like a couple of them are like really blurry or like like it was just like there's weird like choices on kind of background and focus that threw me off.
Yeah, it's like all that was.
I might not have been paying attention enough at a certain point to catch some of that. But going back to what David was saying at the beginning of like your part was like them going to all these different worlds. Like the world is very interesting. The Imperium, their whole like I know it's very much a copy of other sci-fi stuff, but like the different worlds that they go to, space Viking village, like that stuff was all really cool. And I wish that the characters were a little bit better because there is a lot of good stuff, I think, in the world building and all, like just the general idea of it. It just kind of came down to execution for me.
So speaking at one of the scenes, I'm curious about your thoughts. You know, as a mythology nerd and a history nerd, what did you guys think about the Korra backstory scene where we see her involved in the plot to kill the king and then, you know, shoot the princess? Like, I'm curious about your thoughts before I say what I thought.
A little on the nose.
Wait, what do you mean by on the nose?
Well,
I mean, it's clearly a reenacting of like Caesar. But I was like, it was fun that there was a little orchestra there. Like that was interesting.
The band that never stops playing while people are being murdered in front of them.
But it's like, so the guy, I forget, Belisarius or whatever his name is. My favorite part of part one was like the post credits or right before the credits where he's in like some mystical world and he's bringing Noble back to life. Like that was cool. And I felt like that actor was doing a good job. But then in that scene, he just seemed way too over the top of like being a little bit too goofy. So I it's like, it would have been better if they had toned him down just a little bit.
Yeah. I was rolling as soon as I saw all the dudes, like the Senate, and they didn't even say senators yet, but like in the Roman robes, I was like, you gotta be fucking kidding me. Like,
and this is and like the future. They're on a spaceship.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, I'm like, come on, like, you can't even be so, like, you know, David, you mentioned actually, and I wrote it down, right? You mentioned that Dune felt like Roman in that there's these great houses and there's but it's like a little more subtle than just, hey guy, like, here's a bunch of dudes, and like they pull out the knives out of there, and I was like, oh, you gotta be fucking kidding me. And
then, I love that.
Belisarius, the guy, was like, I don't know, something I didn't like his face, and he was not a good actor. He was like who I wrote down as like anytime this guy's on screen, like I don't believe, and he's the big bad, and I don't like, I just think he looks goofy, and his line delivery was really poor. So that scene, but I did love the orchestra. You know, they stop for dramatic pauses and then they continue, right? And but yeah, that scene was like one of the big eye rolls for me, where I was like, you gotta be like so on the nose. And then I actually liked Ed Skrein, though, or Ed Skrein. Like, I don't know what you guys thought about him, but when he's first resurrected, and we're on the bridge of the ship, and there's kind of the captain of the ship, and he's on speakerphone with the med bay, and Ed Skrein's just kind of complaining on speakerphone, let me out of these things, right, on speakerphone. It reminded me of like Kylo Ren, the SNL skit, where they have like Kylo Ren, you know, at the Death Star, and everyone hates him, and they're trying to avoid him because he's just like such a complainer and a whiner. And so I actually really like that scene, but then I couldn't like help but cringe when they resurrect him. He's wearing like a desert robe now for sort of no reason, and there's a halo, like there's a golden halo, and he says Savior, and I was like, what the? I was like, what are you trying to say, like? What are you trying to say, Zack Snyder? Because like, why is this like Jesus? Like, tell me, like, give me something, because like that's what you're trying to make me think about, and I don't know why.
Well, that's yeah, like, is. Yeah, like you're saying, a lot of it is just like images for the sake of being images. So there's like the Savior thing, and then there's the whole like after the murder, all the senators, or like Belisarius is like, she did it, and then all the senators like, yeah, she did it in slow motion, murderer. And they're like, you don't have to, like, no one else is here. You don't have to prove it to anyone. You're all in on this. You can just, like, you don't have to all pretend and act like she actually did it, because everyone here knows that you all did it. Like, it's just, so like such strange choices. And then when you're talking about like the band pausing for dramatic effect, I just imagine like it's actually silent in there. So like the band stops playing, like when the band pauses, you just hear just like stabbing noises.
You're like, images for the sake of images is going to be the title of Zack Snyder's biography.
I love that scene. I love how on the nose it was. I know I have a different opinion than the three of you, but even like, yeah, the band is fantastic. Like they're playing and then all these things happening and they're changing the tones of the music as things are happening in this whole thing, you know? And, you know, Rebel Moon 2 had this same thing, this Roman imagery, this military political system that's ruling, you know, the entire universe. And to have them dress the senators, pull out the knives, I'm like, okay, we're doing the Caesar thing. Great. Like, that's awesome, right? And like you said, Paulo, even them all shouting, like, murderer, like, all being in on it, I'm thinking, like, well, you know who's a traitor if they don't say it, right? So there's this whole thing where, like, you have to say it, and you have to be in on it, or else they're going to murder you next. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's just this allegiance of everybody being in on this giant plot. But as far as, like, the... It's funny because both movies kind of have this messianic imagery going on. You know what I mean? Like Rebel Moon 2 has this idea of a messiah who's going to defeat all the enemies of the people, right? And that's how he comes to play. And in this one here, when you have, you know, I saw the image with the halo and I'm like, is that intentional or is that just the shot? You know what I mean? Is that what they were going for? But yeah, just all these different images going on. Even when they shoot the princess and she explodes in light and then she's not dead. And I'm just like, okay, like we know she's not dead, even though you shot her. Like, you know, so
I thought she was dead. I thought she was for sure dead.
I immediately was like, she's not dead. She's going to come back. 100%, right?
Which is too bad because that's probably one of the more interesting pieces of character development in these two movies is having, like, they flirt with anti-heroes in a lot of movies these days, but it's really just, like, a hero who says, like, swear words. It's not, like, an actual anti-hero, but to have a character that actually killed a young girl, like, that's actually, that's something you would regret. That's something that's, like, adds a little backstory. So if she ends up not being dead, then it's like, oh, okay, that's the only thing we had, and now it's gone.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, in a lot of movies, they don't kill kids, right? And you don't see the imagery of them killing kids. So I was kind of curious how they were going to do it. I think it's one of those things that changes the rating of the movie a lot, right? And overall, I think the only other movie I've seen them where they actually just killed off a kid was Hereditary, when she hits her head against the pole and it's just like she's done. But that was the only movie I've ever seen them like murder a child, like, and do it and show something like that. Usually, like, you know, they'll have a murder and they close the door and then, you know, you just kind of know the kid's dead. But they showed something which I was kind of like, okay, well, that's different.
In Alien versus Predator, one kid gets killed by...
Were you really?
Yeah. A kid gets killed by a chest burster. That's the only other one that I remember. Like, you actually see it, too.
I was going to say the worst version of it is actually Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining, if you guys have seen. And that's one where they don't hold back at all.
One's sad. Yeah. I feel really bad. I don't know if you guys have seen that, like David or John. But...
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay. It's like they're vampires, or like they steal people's like life essence, and then there's like a little boy that they kidnap from a baseball game or something.
So Jacob.
And then they all just. Yeah. And they all just hold him down and like they're murdering him. Like, and it's such a long scene too, and he's like crying. And it's so, like, uncomfortable.
Anyway, I'm going to change the subject from child murder. So that green, huh? So that was one thing we were talking about from part one, was, like, how are they going to get away from the point where the spaceship could just shoot the entire village? Like, there's no point of having any... So, but they had this weird plot line about them surrounding green as if the entire Imperium needs a few sacks of green, which I thought was a really weird choice. And it's like they put a lot into that and it didn't matter at all.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. I mean, you know, we're not going to blow up this village because we need this grain. And then literally a couple scenes later, they're using these like walkers to blow up the buildings with the grain around them anyway. And I'm just like, this is totally pointless.
You need to have some like line in there where they're like, oh, these, you know, the homeland is starving and like noble. If you don't bring back this grain, you're going to be fired. So on, like, but they don't even ever try to do that.
I just couldn't believe that this small village could produce enough grain to meaningfully be required for this level of, you know, military might to come down and take it. Like, that was my big, that's one of my biggest problems about getting into the movie at all, was kind of believing, you know, because going back to Dune and versus Rebel Moon, right? Like, we have these cartoonish villains in Dune as well. But it's like, you understand their motivation. Okay, they're trying to, you know, control this resource, which everybody needs to survive and do space travel and all. And it's all here, right? It's like, the critical mass is here. But in this one, it's like, eh, there's, you know, we were coming to tax some wheat off a town of 50 people. Like, we got this spaceship that has how many thousand soldiers, you know? And it's just like, I'm just...
And yeah, what are they going to do? Do they, can they make stuff out of the grain on the spaceship? Like, it's never...
And I didn't see anybody eating on that spaceship.
Yeah. Oh, because they didn't have the grain.
Yeah, like with the spice in Dune, like, you have that clear correlation to oil. So it's like, you understand the value of it. And in Rebel Moon, like, you've literally seen the Imperium take over multiple planets and presumably all of their resources. So, like, yeah, it was just, I was shocked how much they put into that grain plotline.
Well, I'll take that even a step further. And, like, the, like, if you remember in part one of Rebel Moon, the whole thing is like, okay, aside from the grain, we need to go and find fighters. So I have to go and find a ship, and that's how I meet Charlie Hunnam, right? But in part two, she has a ship right next to the village that they just use anyway, and there's no problem. Like, it works perfectly fine. So, like, what was the whole point of going to, like, the village and finding a pilot and taking them to other planets when they could have just done that with the ship that she had there? And so, like, that already is, like, it makes part one completely pointless. You just take the ship, put the people on the ship, and leave. But also the grain. Like, I don't know. But that kind of stuff, early on in the movie, I you can tell what kind of movie it is. So all this stuff kind of just helped me enjoy it more, just to, like, pick it apart. And then I had the extra action at the end, which was fun. So, I mean,
I was just gonna say, I forget who mentioned at the beginning, but, like, you mentioned this being a certain type of movie, and I think maybe, John, it was you had mentioned, like, expectations and how that helps you enjoy a movie or not. I had such little expectations going in for Rebel Moon Part Two that when I sat down, I actually believed it was going to surpass my expectations. And, like, within the first 10 minutes, I was like, oh, God, it's worse.
Yeah. I kept thinking about other things. And, like, I don't know if you guys, have you seen the show Andor?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of a similar thing, right? There's this evil empire, and we've got a small village, like his little mining village, right? That's kind of under occupation. And it's like a story of the start of the rebellion, right? And, like, the spark that launches. Because obviously, like, this movie is intended to be, like, this Rebel Moon is probably the inspiration for all the rebels all over the galaxy. And I'm assuming, like, from that very first scene with the robot in Rebel Moon 1, I was assuming, like, okay, there's an army of robots that are going to become activated to help the good guys, right? Like, and I didn't see that yet, but now I'm thinking it's coming in the future movies. But to me, like, it was just like, that was the rebellion done so much better. Like, at the end, there wasn't a big battle with spaceships, like a bunch of spaceships and lasers. It was like a street fight where guys were, like, smacking stormtroopers with bricks, right? And, like, to me, that fight scene was, like, incredible. Like, the buildup, you have the speech on the funeral, right, with the hologram. And I was like, fuck yeah. I'm like, pick up the rocks, guys. Like, pick up the rock, right? And then they're going to do it. And, like, to me, like, I just kept on thinking about, and because this movie, like, references and is inspired by all these other things, like, I couldn't help but think about, like, that, which to me, again, it's just all about the characters. Like, I really cared about the characters. I understood the society a little better. I kind of believed it. And yeah, it's like the spectacle battle to me was like a little, like, street fight and riot. But to me, that was just, like, so much more exciting. And because they didn't use slow-mo all the time, which completely took me out every time. Like, they, like, sparingly, slow-mo, very cool, right? But, like, all the time, I'm like, I just can't.
I think you need to have a word with Zack Snyder.
Speaking of motivational speeches, I literally laughed when there was a scene when Jimon Hunsu is like doing a big motivational speech in a spit in a shed before they launch a surprise attack on the people outside that shed. And I'm just imagining the soldiers outside like listening to this huge motivational speech and somehow not being surprised. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, on top of that, it's like Jimon Hunsu again, genius General Titus, and his big plan is let's just rush this strong military with a bunch of villagers just head on. Let's just rush at them. This is my big plan.
Because actually, I like the original traps, right? Like the original traps they had set out. I was like, okay, that's like fun, and like it's easy for you to get into like, hey, these villagers are defending from the evil, and that was kind of cool. But yeah, then they kind of throw that away, and they burst out of sheds, which in theory would make them very easy to shoot, right? Like I just shoot at the door of the shed.
Yeah, I mean, you guys brought the robot and I'm like, oh, I was waiting for him to come into this entire movie. The whole time he's just kind of watching for like an hour and a half, just like watching these people get ready, and then decides, okay, I'm gonna help them now, you know what I mean? And I didn't like that trump card that they always play where like there's always something to come save you at the end, right? So they can't kill the tanks, so the robot comes, and then you know they're about to get bombed, and then you know the rebel fleet shows up, and I'm just like, okay, it's kind of played out a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, even like that last moment of desperation, like where the you know the bird riding guy who doesn't even ride bird in this movie, which is a miss, and the other woman are kind of there at the front lines of the trench, and they see the big army, and you know, instead of like maybe doing something a little interesting where he's like, he says, oh, like, I always thought I wanted to die in battle, but now I don't really want to die at all. And I was like, okay, like maybe interesting. But he's like, then he grabs her arm. He's like, but I will die with you. And I was like, oh, like it could have been like interesting, right? It could have been like a little bit different where he's like, no, actually, I don't want to die, and just kind of leave it there. And I was
and
like,
then he just runs away,
right? Or like you know what I mean? Like, or it makes it like a little sad if he does get iced, right? But then it's just, and he's like, no, I'm not gonna die with you. And just because I'm so far out of it, I just can't take any of that seriously, right? And I roll my eyes again.
And I think that's the point. It's not supposed to be taken as a serious movie. It's a little ridiculous, right? And I've seen worse movies or worse action movies with like, you know, B-list actors that are worse. And I'm like, this isn't bad for what it is. But I mean, is it a little below Zack Snyder? Like maybe.
Yeah, I mean, like for me, it was still enjoyable. I mean, there's definitely worse. But I think the weird thing is that I feel like Zack Snyder was trying to make it very serious, and like everyone in the movie, they're like super committed. Like I give them kudos because everyone's bought in. Like Jimon Hunsu is so serious and like he's so intense, and I love him for that, because like I think it doesn't do anything for his character. I'm cheering for him because he's Jimon Hunsu. But yeah, like and Sofia Boutella, she's like just crying all the time, and I'm like, damn, you're really going for it. And I respect it. It's just like, it's just so strange that, I don't know, like how it ended up this way.
I'll never forget Jimon Hunsu out of my head from Blood Diamond. Like, where is the diamond? Show me the diamond. And I was like, oh, this is, I'll never unsee it.
I think if there was a bit of humor, like I could have, because it just felt like without any humor, it feels like it's like insisting upon itself. And it's like, this is like the most important thing you've seen. And so it's like, I feel like for me to like be in that mindset where like, okay, this is supposed to be silly, like number one would be a little humor because it was kind of joyless. And then number two would be like, I don't like the slow-mo to me feels like you're trying to present this as super serious and dramatic. And like when the slow-mo is always happening to me, that is the director saying, this is cool. Like you're supposed to think this is cool. and so I just couldn't get that out of my head because that's how I interpreted like the slow motion, which was everywhere.
Yeah, this movie really needed like a Drax character or like someone that was just like a little more goofy in personality. And then Jimon Hunsu being the one serious one of the group would work. But it's just like, yeah, I wish it was a lot more sillier, in which case I would have been able to do away with a lot of this stuff, because you're just, you know, it's like, hey, this is just a fun movie. But yeah, it does kind of take itself a little bit too seriously considering what it is.
Yeah, like the band of like the characters don't really play off each other at all. like they're all kind of just doing their own thing. They're never, except for like maybe one moment where Tarak is like, I'll die with you. And but other than that, they never really interact aside from like they just take turns. This is my story. This is my story.
I thought that they were all going to die because Duna Bay's character, I think she dies, if I remember correctly. And then I assumed that more of them were going to get killed off because it's like, I don't know, I guess that's something to do. And then, when Jimon Hunsu's standing on the bridge there and then Tarak is like, he says that line, I'm like, okay, this is going to happen. And then just like, nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the only sacrifice was from Ray Fisher in the first movie. And then, actually, going back to, I think, what David brought up about the fleet coming in at the end, like they have no reason to be there. I was just, that was one thing that really bothered me as well. Like they're never mentioned once in this entire movie. Like the sister's part ends in the first one when she leaves her brother and then they decide to just come and save the village out of nowhere.
I mean, Milicent or whatever her name was part of that crew. So I'm guessing she called it, but
did she? Like, it's never like, it's never mentioned.
Which was also another huge missed opportunity because I think we had joked in Rebel Moon Part 1 where Milicent is like super dedicated to Ray Fisher. And you're like, wow, like she's really into like him dying. And then they don't really set it up as to why. And so like they give her when they're sitting around the table talking, like they have her talk about how he said, it's like, okay, I understand this a little bit more, but they really needed that scene to go on a little bit and like tie that loose end with Ray Fisher dying and like, you know, have a scene with the sister and talk about like how much she meant, because that also would have made it a little bit more understandable of why that, you know, crew was coming in at the end. But just like needed a few, maybe we'll get that in the Snyder cut of this.
Maybe. And then also on top of that, like I remember at the end when they're doing the funeral and then the sister is talking to the villagers and like about her brother and he's like, honor my brother. And it's like, none of these villagers know who your brother is. Like he was never there. They don't know who you are. No one ever mentioned you. Like, why are you talking to them? But it's just like, even like as much as I'm griping, like all these things added to the enjoyment for me. So I'm going to try and take it easy a little bit because I did I did think that it was at least fun. Like it was a lot more fun than the first one for sure.
So maybe question for you guys then, will you watch Rebel Moon 3 if they make it?
Oh, 100%.
Now that I've watched the two of them, I may have to. Like, I watched the first one for this. You know, I watched both of them because of this. Otherwise, I wouldn't have watched them. so maybe, because, like, yeah, I don't know. But it would have to be, like, I'm, like, sitting alone and I've got nothing better to do. Like, actually, I watched the first one. Like, my wife was out for the evening. And I was like, okay, great. I'm going to watch this movie because I'm going to be embarrassed watching it with her. And then I watched like Ricky Stenicki after, which was another movie I thought was going to be dumb, which again was more dumb fun. And it was trying to be dumb fun than either of these movies. So I'd watch Ricky Stenicki 2 before I'd watch Rebel Moon 3, but I might have to watch Rebel Moon 3 now.
And I think that's the point. It's like, it's something you'd really just watch on Netflix. Like it's not, you're not going to the movies to go see Rebel Moon 3 by any means. You're going to be at home, you know, looking for something just to pass the time and just watch. And like Rebel Moon 3 is going to be on it. Be like, yeah, okay, why not? You know exactly what you're going to get. It's not going to be surprising. It's like, oh no, I know exactly where this movie's going.
The benefit of it being on Netflix is that we're guaranteed part 3. Because if this came out in theaters, it would have ended at part 1.
Absolutely.
Yeah, apparently, like, he was, like, they were talking about Zack Snyder, about whether he's going to make more Army of the Dead, and they're like, well, Netflix wants me to make more Rebel Moon movies before I get to those, so I guess they are coming.
Yeah, I'm desperately waiting for a sequel to that, yeah. That was another one, man. It really makes me question, because I hadn't seen, like, I'd seen, like, 300 and Dawn of the Dead, like, in, you know, whenever they came out when I was, like, 14. Ish back in the day, and then I never saw anything else by Zack Snyder, so like I haven't seen any of the DCEU movies except for like Wonder Woman 2 on a plane and Shazam 1, and so I didn't know anything about Zack Snyderisms. Like I'd obviously seen memes and then I watched like Army of the Dead, like, you know, it kind of in my bedroom on my laptop, and I was like, what is this? And yeah, it's interesting. Like I'm like, what happened?
That one's especially confusing because he can make a good zombie movie. Like you mentioned, Dawn of the Dead. Yeah. I loved that movie back in the day. That was a really good one. And I mean, Army of the Dead is not super bad, but it's kind of... it's
yeah, like at least strange. I like the German guy. Like I, that was funny to me. I'm like, okay, you got this German guy. That's funny. He's got an accent. That's all it takes.
Didn't they end up making like a sequel or a prequel dedicated to that character?
About him, yeah.
I did not watch it.
Army of Thieves or something like that.
Yeah.
Thieves of the Dead.
I think it's Army of Thieves. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Any last comments you guys have on Rebel Moon before we wrap this up?
I can't wait for another dramatic montage of grain farming in part 3. It's the big preparation for the final battle against Belisarius. More grain. Hide behind bags of grain so they can't shoot us.
If you think about it, it's the same as, like, it literally, that is the same as Dune, where he's like, I have the spice, I'll blow it up. Like, if you guys don't do what I want, like, I'm going to blow up the spice, right?
Yeah.
This grain.
Yeah. Wow. It's one thing we never really got into too much about, like, they did rip off a lot of really big sci-fi properties, even calling her the Scargiver, which is like kind of a callback to the fact that they almost called Luke Skywalker Starkiller, I felt like. But there's like so many parallels and like things that they either rip off or homage about other sci-fi stuff. But
now that you mentioned it, sorry, I'm continuing, but like, did they ever explain why the nickname was Scargiver? Like she killed people, but like
the death was the death of the king was a scar on the Imperium. I don't know. That's what I always assumed.
Yeah, I mean, okay. They missed the scene where she could have tried to like kill Belisarius and missed and given him a scar. You know what I mean? Like there's so many things that they could have done with it, and they just kind of left it alone.
Or the little girl princess has a nasty scar from where she shot her.
People don't usually talk in context of scars when it's a dead body, though.
We'll just add that to the list of things that didn't make sense.
All right. Well, we will end it off there. And as we usually end off our episodes, we will mention some movies that we're looking forward to coming out. I'll start first because you guys might not have remembered we were going to end like this. So I am looking forward to... The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which is Guy Ritchie's new movie with Henry Cavill and the guy who plays Reacher, because I've heard a lot about this guy and I want to see him in something. And the only other thing I've seen him in is Fast 10 or Furious 10 or whatever it was, which was goofy.
Is that the same guy?
I assumed it was, but maybe I'm wrong. There's a scene in Fast 10 where we meet... Captain Marvel, whatever her name is.
It is him. Sorry. Yes.
And then like, I'm going on a tangent on Fast 10 now. It was the only scene in the movie that I actually laughed at because like all of the proportions of the people in Fast 10 are like not real. Like it's more comical than a Marvel movie. And so like when they eventually ramped up and then this guy's character came out, I'm like, this is a joke. Like who's ever doing that? Like this is not a real human being. This is not what human beings look like. So I laughed at that scene, but I understand that he is an actual person who is in other shows. So I'm looking forward to seeing him in like a real movie now.
Either of you guys want to go next?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go. I mean, I'm looking forward to two, Gladiator 2. I mean, they haven't made one of those since like the 90s. And it's one of those staple movies that I don't know if it's going to turn out to be really well or really bad. But definitely looking forward to that. And also Alien Romulus. I mean, I'm a huge fan of like the Alien series. You know, the last couple, they were okay. Like, you know, did they really do it justice? Like, I don't really know. But I mean, I'm always happy to take on another Alien movie.
Took mine.
Sorry.
It's okay. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, for me, I think it's Furiosa. I kind of mentioned this at the beginning about surprise, and one of the things I'll always remember, I wasn't really into like watching many movies growing up other than the blockbusters and stuff, and now this was a blockbuster, but I remember one time going to theater with my buddies and we're like, hey, do you want to watch Avengers Age of Ultron, or do you want to watch Mad Max Fury Road? I'd never seen anything Mad Max. And we were just like, well, let's just watch this Mad Max thing instead. And I remember just like my mind being blown because I had no idea what it was going to be about. And I didn't see any trailers. And so Furiosa, I mean, now I have expectations because I've seen the other Mad Max movies. But, you know, for me, Furiosa is the thing I'm looking forward to because I had such a good experience with Mad Max.
That's a good one. Yeah, so I was going to say Alien Romulus. But I guess another second place goes to Cuckoo, which is some like a strange horror movie. I think it's from, I could be wrong about this, but I think it's from the A24 studio, which usually does some good stuff. But it has the trailer is super creepy. And I might not even be able to watch it because I'm scared. But it's about this girl who's like, I think her family has to move to a resort, but there's like, it's weird. Like it seems like everyone has a secret or everyone knows her. And then there's like some weird creature or like messed up woman following her. I would say check out the trailer because I definitely cannot explain it. As well as the trailer is creepy. So yeah, that's mine.
All right, we're looking forward to those. John, David, thanks for stopping by. Fun conversation, and for our audience, tune in again for our next episode. See you again next month.